Just this week, Tammy Baldwin, along with 18 other U.S. senators, sent a letter to the Food and Drug Administration in support of a ban on menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And tobacco companies have directly marketed menthols to black people. The Kaiser Family Foundation says that Wisconsin has the highest rate of black adult smokers in the country, giving us the greatest racial disparity in smoking from coast to coast. So what are we going to do about that? You can join our conversation this half hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guests, Doug Jorenby is Director of Clinical Services for UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Doug, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
And also joining us this morning, Lorraine Lathan, founder and president of Jump at the Sun Consultants, which is the organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network and the Wisconsin Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. Lorraine, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Lorraine, I will start with you and get your reaction to what the FDA proposed in April, a ban on menthol cigarettes, and what Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin seems to support along with 18 other U.S. senators. Why would that be important, or why wouldn't that matter to your work?
It's very important. We're thrilled that this has finally come to into existence. It's important because, first of all, let me tell you this. It's not surprising that we have these disparities in Wisconsin. There's so many other disparities that we're dealing with as it relates to education, income, healthcare access, and other issues that contribute to chronic disease and poor health. So it's important to have this ban. We have 45,000 African Americans that die each year as a result of tobacco. The ban is going to address issues of health inequities and also social justice. It's also a social justice issue.
Well, what is it about these menthol cigarettes, Lorraine?
The problem with the menthol cigarettes is very there's lots of issues. But menthol cigarettes, they are easier to start and they're more difficult to quit. The mentholated flavoring, it removes the harshness of tobacco. So it makes it easier to begin smoking. And also for many, many decades, the tobacco industry has targeted the African-American community for this particular product that is, again, more addictive. In Wisconsin, 88% of all black smokers smoke mentholated tobacco products.
Wow. And the numbers I have here from the PBS NewsHour, Lorraine, is that menthol cigarettes now account for more than one-third of all cigarettes sold in the U.S. There's a disparity there. And Doug Jorenby, in your position as the Director of Clinical Services for the UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, you can go back to 2009, I believe, right? That was the Tobacco Control Act, which would allow the FDA to regulate the tobacco industry. Why are we in 2022 right now talking about something that could address the racial disparities in smoking in Wisconsin? What's this process been like?
Well, it's, it's the making of sausage in Washington, D.C., to use a really blunt metaphor. But there has been a tremendous amount of pushback. And, you know, the figure you just cited about how significant menthol sales are in terms of national tobacco sales is a big part of that, that the tobacco industry has pushed back in, very, very indirect and subtle ways for a number of years until finally this proposal came out to ban menthol as a flavoring. For very, very sound public health and scientific reasons. And now that's all become very overt. And, you know, the big tobacco companies are in the process of taking the FDA to court to try to stop that. So as compelling as that case is, and Ms. Lathan's group has done a great job of really highlighting the disproportionate impact it has on the black community, particularly in Milwaukee, it's not going to happen overnight. A lot of people are going to have to keep pushing to see this make progress.
So while the ability for the FDA to do this in 2000 occurred with legislation in 2009 and 2022, there is still work ahead. Some of it will be in the court. Some of it will be just public opinion. But going back to the PBS NewsHour's reporting on this here, the FDA says half of kids who smoke use menthols today. So, Doug, what other major challenges are health professionals facing when it comes to preventing kids from smoking today?
Well, you know, that's something where we've actually seen some progress in the short term. Certainly, as was mentioned earlier, you know, menthol is a gateway in that it's easier for kids to start that. It's less harsh. They're able to draw it more deeply into their lungs. But actually not with cigarettes, but with e-cigarettes, with vaping, and the fact that the federal government did move very quickly to ban flavorings in e-cigarette juice. We actually have seen a lot of progress because the sweet, the fruit, the sugar cereal dessert kind of flavors that e-juice was available in were really popular to adolescents and young adults, often cases people who had never used cigarettes at all. And those were actually taken off the market quite quickly. And some of the folks who had been using that were then falling back to menthol. So I think there's a precedent there. There's a pathway that we potentially can follow to help people get off these products or even more effectively to never start using them in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Doug Jordanby there directs clinical services for UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Also joining us, Lorraine Lathan, who directs the City of Milwaukee Tobacco Free Alliance and is in charge of the organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network and the Wisconsin Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. And we invite you to the discussion as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So if we were to begin digging, Lorraine, I would be interested in knowing in your experience, in your work every day, what you see is what's causing some of these disparities in smoking habits in Wisconsin.
I would say we were fortunate to participate in a study by the State of Wisconsin's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program, where we looked at kind of the habits of tobacco retailers and we are in terms of marketing. So we learned that in the city of Milwaukee, that tobacco retailer density, that's the number of retailers per 1,000 residents, is much higher. It's twice as high as in the suburbs. So you have a population that is being constantly exposed to and inundated with tobacco marketing, outdoor marketing, tobacco discounts, anything that can be appealing, make tobacco products appealing. We're seeing tobacco products that are placed at eye level for children, near toys and candy and
still?
Whatnot.
So, still?
Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
Yes,
and you mentioned that number two times as many in black neighborhoods compared to others in Wisconsin. But that goes back to the Kaiser Family Foundation numbers I have here that's based on the CDC data that says black adults in Wisconsin are around 2.5 times more likely to smoke than white folks in the state. But you also mentioned there's a context of racial disparities in Wisconsin that we're dealing with. But this one should be easy. This one should not be. I mean, smoking kills. So how do we go about stopping people from starting? And I go back to Doug's talk about the kids. What do you do, Lorraine, to keep kids away from nicotine and nicotine addiction?
We've been working with our youth. We have young people who engage in education and outreach to their peer groups. We're trying to change social norms around smoking, that it's not cool, you know, to smoke. And we know that it's an addiction. So with adults, we have been working to refer people to the Wisconsin Quit Line, get people into smoking cessation groups. Again, it is an addiction. Why are people smoking? There's so many different reasons. And we do a lot of focus groups. So when we talk to people, they talk about all of the pressure that life, the pressure of living that is causing people to smoke and kind of feel as if they're being relieved from some of that for a short period, and then they start smoking again. So with our young people, they're out educating. With adults, the ones that are smoking, we're trying to get them into programs that will help them quit and stay quit. So that's So that's some of the things that we've been doing many years now.
Lorraine Lathan, our guest, along with Doug Jornby, and we're taking a look at the racial disparities of smoking in Wisconsin and what can be done to curb them. If you want to know what it's like to try to quit smoking, hold your breath. Keep holding it. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, if you are with the experience of quitting smoking, and smokers who have quit know this all too well, keep holding that breath. We'll be right back. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Still holding your breath. For nicotine addicts, trying to quit cigarettes can feel like drowning. It can feel like your skin is peeling off of you. It can feel like one thing you've got to do is light up. And so when we're talking about the smoking rates in Wisconsin, the racial disparities that we found from data from the Kaiser Family Foundation, we're talking about a two-pronged approach. The best way to quit smoking is to never start and never get the nicotine in your system. And after you do, well, then it is about dealing with an addiction, a physical addiction that will literally make you feel like you can't breathe. So our guests are Doug Jornby, Director of Clinical Services for the UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, and Lorraine Lathan, founder and president of Jump Sun Consultants, an organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network and the Wisconsin Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. Join us, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And Lorraine, a little bit more about these menthol cigarettes, as earlier this week, Senator Baldwin, along with 18 other senators, called on the FDA to go ahead and ban those menthol cigarettes. As Doug mentioned, this is now going to the courts where the cigarette companies will be battling the FDA. But what more can you say about this menthol ban and what it would do for smoking rates in Wisconsin and the racial disparity of smoking rates in Wisconsin?
Well, considering that 88% of the smokers, African-American smokers, smoke menthol-laden tobacco products, by banning menthol, that will save lives. It will prevent people from getting addicted, and it will help, hopefully, encourage people who are smoking to reduce and or quit smoking. So basically, it will save lives across the board in terms of with teens, young people, anybody who's smoking. It will help to save lives. I did want to make one important kind of remark about the ban in the tobacco industry.
Yes.
Because again, this ban is going to be very costly to the tobacco industry. Menthol is a moneymaker for the industry. And so now the tobacco industry is pushing this very false narrative that the proposed ban will lead to negative police interactions with African Americans.
How so?
So the truth of the matter is that the ban is against the manufacturers and the sellers of tobacco products. It's not against individuals. So we've been hearing these scare tactics that because of policing and enforcement, tobacco enforcement, more minorities are going to interact with the police as a result of this. And so I guess what I would say is to put this in perspective. We're talking about 45,000 African-American lives that are lost each year because of tobacco. And so we should not walk away from looking at implementing a ban because of this false narrative that, again, the tobacco industry has been putting out for quite some time now.
Because what this ban would be against the manufacturers and the cigarette companies, not the actual end users.
Correct.
Thank you for that. Correct. And Doug Jornby, I understand recent research from the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention is focusing on finding new ways to reach out through tobacco cessation outreach specialists. Specialists can help people quit smoking. How's that work?
Yeah, well, we've known for a long time that when you add counseling to medication, you were mentioning in the transition from the news break, you know, how incredibly difficult it is for somebody who's dependent on nicotine to just quit cold turkey to, in essence, throw away their cigarette or throw away their e-cigarette and go through withdrawal. So medication definitely helps reduce the withdrawal and craving, and that increases people's chances of success. But also when we do counseling, and particularly in the context that we're talking, when that counseling is tailored, so it's relevant to the community that's receiving it, it's culturally competent, if you will, it's even more effective. And we've seen success rates go up on the order of 2 to 3 times based on people who receive that kind of relevant counseling to help them quit.
So cessation outreach specialists who are culturally prepared, that are matched, that you can see yourself in others. But have you ever met a smoker who didn't want to quit, Doug?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're definitely out there. And, you know, a lot of people start as adolescents and it just becomes kind of a core part of who they are. And so the thought of getting particularly cigarettes out of their life just leaves this kind of hole in their identity. And that, as well as just the sheer difficulty of quitting and staying quit, can be really intimidating for people. But there's a lot of options, both in terms of, you know, as we were saying, the medication to help reduce some of the physical discomfort with it, but also, you know, whether it's support from other people that are going through the same thing and, you know, can be a guide and example for folks. Helping them do some active problem solving. There's a whole variety of ways that we can help people be more successful in making that decision that, you know, it's not an exaggeration for someone who uses tobacco. That is the single most powerful thing they can do to improve their health and quality of life.
That's Doug Jornby, Director of Clinical Services at UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Our other guest, Lorraine Lathan, founder and president of Jump at the Sun Consultants, the organization that oversees the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network and the Wisconsin Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. You are welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. And Lorraine Lathan, you talked earlier about working with kids to prevent starting smoking in the first place. But how, in your role with the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network and the Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network in Wisconsin, how important are culturally competent smoking cessation specialists to help with your work, whether it's to prevent smoking to start or to help them quit?
It's very important. And thank you for asking that question. I think what happens is when you're helping someone to start their quit journey, it's important to be able to provide examples and to teach and support in a way that is relatable to that person. And so we've worked in terms of, we've used the Freedom from Smoking cessation that's developed by the American Lung Association. That's a curriculum that we've used to help people. And we've made changes to it to make sure that it speaks and resonates with the populations that we're working with. We've noticed that there are so many people who want to quit, as many as those who are saying, okay, I'm not quitting because I don't think I'm going to be successful. There's twice as many that are looking at saying, I want to be around for my daughter's wedding, to see my grandkids grow up. I just need help. I just need support. And so we've been able to support in smaller groups. People are able to work together and get that support from a neighbor, for instance, that has also started their quit journey. But making sure that it's relevant to them, that it speaks to them, and quite often it's kind of helping them to identify what are the triggers? What are the triggers that make you want to smoke? And then what kind of plan of action can you put in place to deal with those triggers?
And Lorraine mentioned it, and Doug, I'll ask you from your research, how many times do you have to quit before you can quit?
It varies tremendously from one person to the next. You know, I've worked with a lot of people that first time out, they get the pieces together and they're successful. We know from national data, it usually takes about 4 to 6 of what people self-describe as serious quit attempts before they're quit for good. And that's a testament to, you know, how tenacious a dependence nicotine creates. But it also, it shows that it's a learning experience. You know, there are plenty of people who are able to quit for a couple of weeks and then, you know, it be in Wisconsin, they go out to a tavern on Friday night with their friends who are still smoking, and somehow they find a cigarette in their hand, and they learn not to let that trip them up the next time. So having that ability, and I agree with what Ms. Layton was saying, that sometimes, you know, having peers, having neighbors, having friends that can help you through this process, you see that as a learning experience, not as a personal failure, and that makes a world of difference.
Doug, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Director of Clinical Services for UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, Lorraine Layton, thank you so much for your time and information as well.
Thank you.
Lorraine is a founder and president of Jump of the Sun Consultants, the organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network and the Wisconsin Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. Ahead this hour, we're exploring how recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions could impact tribal nations here in Wisconsin. And we invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Your news is next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And let's take some time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's our friend Mary Kate McCoy with a story about embracing new experiences.
Writer Jill Sisson Quinn and her son had a summer routine. They would go to their local lake for a chilly early morning swim almost every day. But last summer, they tried somewhere new. The experience opened Quinn's eyes to the joys of both new and old loves.
My go-to lake is Sunset in Portage County, a few minutes from my home. When my son was an infant, I planted his feet in its warm sand. I pushed him on the swing while he alternately dozed and watched green darners, belted kingfishers, and bald eagles. Even as, over the years, Sunset's water level rose, swallowing the beach, engulfing the swing set, and turning the picnic tables into strange diving platforms, we continued our near-daily summer visits. They began in late May, when I'd return from my morning walk to my son waiting on the porch in his swim trunks. We'd arrive at sunset before 8 a.m., alone but for one older couple who braved the icy water with us. But last summer, I cheated on sunset. I enrolled my son in swimming lessons at Waupaca County's Shadow Lake, a farther drive to a more populated area. Shadow seemed a little less wild, with its slides, lifeguards, freeze pops, and flushable toilets. The water was more shallow and warm. Folks warned by summer's end there might be lots of goose poop. Cars ran visibly along a fairly busy road on the lake's western side. Because of this, I assumed there was a dam somewhere and the lake was man-made. Gradually, we fell in love with Shadow. I watched the teenage swim instructors progress from organizing games of hula hoop tag to teaching my son the crawl. They showed him how to give himself over to the water, how a quick turn of the head and in-breath is all he really needs of the landed environment. There is something so right about watching high schoolers teach younger kids. A friend once summed it up for me. Teenagers so need to be loved, and children so love teenagers. We didn't visit Sunset for weeks. My son found a lost beach ball in the wetlands east of Shadow, and thus began pickup games of soccer before lessons. After class, he would play on the raft and the slide with whoever was there, girls and boys alike of varying ages, who barely knew each other's names, brought together by this lake. Some pretty natural things can happen at an unnatural lake, I left thinking one day, musing about my shifting love from Sunset to Shadow. But Shadow Lake is not man-made. Like Sunset, it formed in a kettle depression left by the retreat of the last glacier, where a huge chunk of ice gradually melted in the newly laid sediment. The lake's only difference is how they get their water. A hardwater seepage lake, Sunset's water comes mainly from groundwater. A drainage lake, Shadow has both an outlet and inlet, and receives water from precipitation, runoff, and another nearby lake. And both lakes have had humans' hands in them, suffered and benefited from our constant remodeling of the environment. Shadow Lake has had its channels renovated. Sunset has endured chemicals to kill off its entire fish population to be replaced with more desirable species. This reminds me that categories exist mostly in the mind. Natural, man-made, seepage, drainage, the lines between them often blurry. Nothing is pure. Passions can shift, and our preconceived ideas about one thing over another only limit our experience. After his final lesson, my son and I returned to Sunset Lake, and that original bond flooded through me like a dream of one's first love, from which you wake thinking still, this many years later, that was the one. And Sunset seemed to forgive our fickleness. That day, unassisted for the first time, my son would swim all the way out to Sunset's buoy, just him and the water and desire. And for that, I cannot deny, I have to thank Shadow.
Jill Sisson Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now, the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court came out last month. It's once again changed recognition of sovereignty of Native American tribes. You're listening to The Morning Show, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And Justice Amy Coney Barrett was not on the court when they reestablished Native sovereignty just 2 years ago, and her addition may signal a shift in how the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court treats the rights of our First Nations. Up next for the court, it has announced that the justices will be going back to decide the fate of the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act. So, what's the future hold for Native American rights and remaining Native American lands? You share your perspective at 1-800-642-1234 or 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut, co-author and member of the editorial board of Felix S. Cohn's Handbook of Federal Indian Law and co-author of leading case books in both property law and American Indian law. Bethany Berger, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
So this decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last month about Native American sovereignty, in the big picture, how do you view the new legal landscape that's facing our First Nations?
Well, it's a mixed picture. This decision was a huge blow, and it suggests that the Supreme Court now is willing to overturn principles that have been established for hundreds of years. So that is very disturbing. With respect to the legal landscape generally, tribes are exercising their rights more effectively than they have in the past, and Congress is more receptive to self-determination in the courts. So while in the Supreme Court it looks bad, the general landscape is mixed.
So as an expert on federal and Native law, are you being asked to provide guidance for tribes, their attorneys, on what this new legal landscape looks like?
I wrote a amicus brief in the Castro Huerta case, the most recent case. And so I'm still involved with the groups that are working with this. And we're all putting our heads together to figure out what can be done next to preserve the rights that tribes have worked so hard for.
And you say that this case, the 5-4 decision from last month, is upending precedent from hundreds of years, but doesn't it just upend the decision from just a couple years ago when Justice Gorsuch was in the majority, writing the majority decision?
No, that's the irony. Huh. So in 2020, the Supreme Court decided McGirt v. Oklahoma, which established that basically the eastern half of Oklahoma was part of five different tribal reservations, that reservations established by treaty back in the 1830s hadn't been destroyed. And since then, Oklahoma has filed more than 40 petitions in the Supreme Court trying to get McGirt overturned. And the court has refused to take any of those petitions. But in Castro Huerta, they took the second half of one of those petitions that said, can the state exercise criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians committing crimes against Indians on reservations? And that's the side they took, the question they took, and five of the justices said they could. And that is what, since the founding of the United States, everyone, courts, legislatures, prosecutors, has understood that states don't have that jurisdiction. That's what the court reversed.
So they do now under the Supreme Court decision. So what is it about this decision, Bethany Berger, that is a departure from how crimes on reservations have been handled historically?
So historically, when the crime involved an Indian, either as a victim or as the defendant, only the federal government or the tribal government had jurisdiction. For a state to have that jurisdiction, you needed congressional consent, really specific congressional consent. And Congress acted on that understanding in 1790, in 1834, in 1948, in 1953. It just kept on enacting statutes based on this understanding. And the Supreme Court said, nope, when the defendant is a non-Indian and the victim is an Indian, the state can prosecute them.
So I know you're a law professor at the University of Connecticut, but I would ask what you know about Wisconsin, our 11 federally recognized tribes that reside here, and how this decision could impact them, Bethany.
Well, so most of the tribes in Wisconsin are covered by a 1953 law called Public Law 280. So that's one of the places where Congress gave the state that specific jurisdiction.
Okay.
Only one, I believe Menominee, is not covered by Public Law 280. And so with respect to that tribe, the decision says, yes, the state has jurisdiction, even though Congress didn't give it to you.
So this Public Law 280 means that there is already state jurisdiction in the 10 of the 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. But this decision from the Supreme Court last month, the Castro Huerta decision, may make that for all of the, including the Menominee?
Yes.
Okay. Our guest, Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut, and we invite you to join us. She's also the co-author and one of the editors of the Felix S. Cohen's Handbook of Federal Indian Law. And we're taking a look at the Supreme Court decision upending precedent that goes all the way back and what that means for Native rights, sovereign territory, and where Native American lands stand today with respect to the United States of America. If you have perspective on this from where you are, we invite you to share that at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our conversation with Bethany Berger continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Native American sovereignty following the 5-4 decision last month of the U.S. Supreme Court that changes some of that, going all the way back to precedent that dates back to the early days of this country. So our guest, Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut and an expert in Native American law, and we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question about the Supreme Court's decision and its impacts across Wisconsin, or if you have a comment about your experiences, we welcome those as well, and you can email us, ideas@wpr.org. Bethany, the 2020 Federal Circuit Court decision affirmed the Oneida Tribe's reservation boundaries in northeastern Wisconsin, and you wrote and filed an argument in support of the Oneida Nation in that case. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved and what that case means for Native sovereignty?
Sure. You know, as you can tell from the McGirt case, I've been involved in questions about reservation boundaries with the Tribal Supreme Court Project for a number of years. And the National Congress of American Indians was wanting to file a friend of the court brief there and asked if I could. And that case basically establishes that the boundaries of the reservation still exist. It was a conflict between Hobart and the tribe about regulation of the tribe's apple festival. And before they could even decide the question of regulation, they had to decide whether the reservation still existed. And so the court held that the reservation does still exist, which means that all the special rules around jurisdiction in Indian country apply.
Bethany, is this now dispute ended, or is there still, do you know whether or not this has been resolved, or does this dispute over boundaries continue?
This is the last word on boundaries, as far as I know. The Supreme Court has not granted certiorari on it. Congress could amend it, but I'm not aware of any effort of Congress to amend it. There are still jurisdictional questions, but at least those jurisdictional questions can start from the assumption that there is a reservation there. The alternative to a reservation is basically what we call a checkerboard area, that in order to determine jurisdiction, you have to see who owns the land. Is it owned by the tribe in trust, or is it owned by a non-Indian? And as you can imagine, that is a super difficult way to run a government.
Yes.
Now we can just say everything is part of the reservation.
We're talking about the impact of the U.S. Supreme Court decision on Native lands here in Wisconsin with Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut and an expert in Native American law, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, where Mike in St. Lawrence is standing by. Mike, good morning. You're on the air with Bethany Berger.
Morning. Yeah, quick question. If this is settled law for such a long, 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 long time, who brought the suit and for what reason? Why did they want to have federal prosecution on Indian lands for a non-Native Indian? Well, I don't understand what the purpose was.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. Let's clarify this. This 5-4 Supreme Court decision that came out last month, who brought the suit and for what reason, Bethany?
Sure. So Oklahoma brought the suit. Basically, the state just refuses to accept the decision that this land is part of a reservation. And since then, they've been looking for any opportunity to get that question back before the court. And basically, this was a question that they hoped to package with the reservation question to have that reheard. And instead, the Supreme Court said, we're not going to rehear the reservation question. We're just going to do this. And this came out of a criminal case involving Mr. Castro Huerta, where the state had first prosecuted him and convicted him. Then after the decision that was part of a reservation, the courts agreed that only the federal government had jurisdiction. So the federal government prosecuted and convicted him. But the state said, no, we don't care that this guy's in jail anyway. We want to use this to bring our claims back to the Supreme Court.
Well, and as I understand it, the decision last month, Bethany, all those who were in the majority in the 2020 decision, McGirt, as you mentioned, were in the minority this time around. And all those that were in the minority 2 years ago were in the majority this time around. And the only difference was the addition to the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. So what does this mean now when the High Court has consolidated four court cases together to challenge the constitutionality of the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act? What do you expect from the court in its next session on this, Bethany?
Yeah, so I am very, very worried about this. So the Indian Child Welfare Act is an extremely important law recognizing the huge rates at which Indian kids are being taken away from their families and from tribes, and trying to ensure that in child welfare cases, both the family has increased procedural rights, that the tribe has the right to try the case, and so on. And the challenge here, what makes this even more disturbing, is the challenge is not to how the statute is interpreted, is whether it's unconstitutional at all. And so the Supreme Court could hold that the statute, by treating Indians and Indian kids differently, violates equal protection. And that would cast a whole lot of Indian law statutes into question.
So this could be this 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act that will be revisited on grounds of constitutionality with our new makeup of our U.S. Supreme Court in their next session could be the start of something and not the end of something when it comes to Native sovereignty. You see a domino effect here, or perhaps a slippery slope?
Yes. And in fact, the attorneys that initially started challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act on constitutionality, some of them got their start challenging Indian gaming and saying that was unconstitutional, or challenging, trying to whittle away at affirmative action generally, or being involved in challenging tribal control of natural resources on their reservations. So I'm very afraid that this is a vehicle to undo Indian law altogether.
Running out of time here this hour, Bethany Berger, but big picture from your experience as an expert in federal and Native American law, it sounds like there, you talk about the 40 lawsuits that we're targeting, trying to get some states' oversight over Native lands, finally getting one through the Supreme Court in the decision last month, and then the next case coming up for the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act. The big picture is, do you see, why are there so many challenges to Native sovereignty right now?
Because, I mean, there's always been challenges to Native sovereignty.
Okay.
There are always groups and individuals that don't like tribes and don't like tribal sovereignty. There have always been these challenges. The difference is that the Supreme Court is willing to hear those challenges, and that the opponents of tribal sovereignty are looking at this court and thinking this is a good moment to possibly undo the principles that they didn't like before.
I have a question here, but we're running out of time. But really quickly, Native people in Southwest Wisconsin, I'm asking about constitutionally protected burial rights in Wisconsin. What do you know about that, Bethany?
I don't know a ton about it. The Native American graves, the NAGPRA, does protect tribal burials on federal and tribal land. I don't think that's under attack.
Okay.
States can also protect grave sites to ensure that people don't go digging up bones.
Bethany, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for sharing this story this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut, co-author and member of the editorial board of the Felix S. Cohn's Handbook of Federal Indian Law, and the co-author of leading casebooks in both property law and Native American law. Just ahead on the anniversary, we've got more ahead with you this morning. Stay tuned. I'm Lee Rayburn. We're going to go to the Grill Master when we continue, and a look at some of the candidates you'll find on your slate for the August 9th primary. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.